I've chosen it because it's not easy. It makes us uncomfortable. And we need to be in that place of feeling a bit uncomfortable in order to understand how integral hope is into building a better world. So I ask you to listen to this story with an open mind and an open heart, and also with the understanding we're not going to stay in this place. We're going to move through it. It's a hot morning in May in the city of Ja'ar in South Yemen. Shopkeepers have opened their stores. Children are ambling to school. The smell of food wafts through the streets of this small town. A goat nibbles on fruit at a market stall as a woman named Lau looks on. Boom. The ground vibrates with the sound of an explosion, and voices immediately rise in distress. Where is it? What's going on? Lau joins the townspeople running through the dusty streets toward that deafening sound. She must find her 18-year-old son, Munir. Now, Lau can't read. She doesn't own a television, but Munir, he always knows what's going on. When a pile of rubble comes into view, a man drops to his knees saying, "Praise Allah, only one house this time." He gestures toward the untouched buildings that surround this rubble pile that had once been a house destroyed by a drone strike. The townspeople sit through the rubble, calling out, "Is anyone there?" There is no response. Hands grip Lau's shoulders and she turns. It is Munir. "Go home," he says gently. "Too many people are here. I will help them lift the heavy pieces." Gratitude washes over Lau. Munir lives. She presses her hands to his cheeks. He nods, and then she begins to walk toward home. As she is just steps away, there is another deafening boom. It is a second missile, and in an instant, 24 people lie dead or dying. Lau knows immediately that Munir is among them. Lau says now that without Munir, she is blind. He was her eyes. She believes that Al-Qaeda is very bad, but her dreams are not haunted by it. Her dreams are haunted by American missiles. Now, she knows nothing about American politics or people. All she knows is that her son is dead, and as far as she is concerned, they are responsible. "They are criminals," she says, tears in her eyes. "Criminals who stole my son." So when I came across that story about a place called Ja'ar, a place I'd never heard of before, and it's spelled J-A-A-R, I kept seeing it as the word jar. You're getting a glimpse into how my brain works, for good or for bad, I don't know. But so I tried to put this out of my mind, thinking it's not connected, but I kept feeling like I was being nudged towards something, however tenuous this connection was. And in this case, that similarity between the town Ja'ar and the word jar kept pushing me toward the story of my great-grandmother. Naturally, right? So when I think of Lau in Ja'ar, I also think of the sorrow that I could see in the eyes of my great-grandmother. But I have to tell you, my great-grandmother's eyes spoke of many other things too. Images of a lifetime lived of almost 100 years, riding side saddle to a one-room schoolhouse in Kentucky, saying goodbye to friends in World War I, watching her son go away to fight in World War II, losing her husband, my grandfather, during the turmoil of the Vietnam War, watching both her adult children succumb to cancer. And through it all, she maintained this mystifying, steadfast courage. One of my favorite stories about her takes place during the Great Depression. So she worked in a department store, and they refused to employ married women. It was a policy they could enforce back then. And so she was forced to secretly marry my great-grandfather. And then when she became pregnant, she was so fearful, and rightly so, of losing that job that she hid that pregnancy under her work smock. and then finally went home on a Friday after a regular work week, gave birth to my grandmother on Saturday morning, and then was back at work Monday morning as though nothing had ever happened. I mean, this was one tough lady, right? So by the time, when I knew Grandma, she was in her 90s and living alone in this apartment filled with the mementos of a lifetime. In her bedroom, there was a worn mahogany vanity top with perfume bottles and framed family pictures and an old mason jar with a scratched lid. And it looked a lot like this jar here. Now, this jar has some slips of paper in it, which we'll talk about in just a minute, but Grandma's jar was filled with peanuts. So I asked her about those peanuts one day. I said, "How come you never eat them?" "They're not there for eating," she said in her sort of stoic way. "They're there for looking at." I asked her why she'd want to look at a jar of peanuts. "Well," she said, "sometimes I get worried about the state of the world. But I sure do like President Jimmy Carter a whole lot. And Jimmy Carter likes peanuts. So I put those peanuts in my hope jar." "What's a hope jar?" I asked. Now, as you probably figured out, my grandmother wasn't one for being sentimental, so she looked embarrassed and cleared her throat. "Well, a hope jar is a place you put something that gives you hope when things are rough. When things look bad, I look at those peanuts, and it makes it better." So this idea of a hope jar stayed with me my whole life. Here was my great-grandmother who had lost loved ones in one war after another, who survived cancer three times herself, only to lose both children to it. And she could find hope in a jar of peanuts. Now, what could be more simply profound than that? Of course, I realized since then that we don't need an actual jar to have a hope jar. Our hearts, our minds can be filled with the things in life that remind us why life is worth living when times are bad. But you know, there's a huge problem that we face. As we open ourselves up to stories like the one we heard today about Lowell and Munir, we can find ourselves shutting down, because the pain of what goes on out in the world is too great if we don't have a foundation for dealing with it. And you may have allowed yourself to really feel that story that I shared with you, but just imagine if that's all I had for you this morning, one story like that after another. And so that is why I believe that we as people of faith, Unitarian Universalists who are called to make the world a better place, we have to have a foundation of intentionally cultivated hope so that we don't burn out from empathizing with the complex pain of the world. Empathy, grounded in hope, then becomes our ethical foundation as we wrestle with maintaining the motivation and perception required to make a positive difference in the world. We need a full hope jar, just like my great-grandmother had, to temper the weight of the pain that we carry through empathy. And we need that empathy to build equitable relationships and make good decisions when helping others. Now you're saying, "That's all very well, Reverend Jason, but the question then becomes, what on earth do we put in our hope jars?" Now, there may still be a few diehard Jimmy Carter fans amongst this group, I know. So peanuts might be it for you. But for the rest of us, finding evidence of hope can be more challenging. So I put a few ideas about hope in this hope jar to give you some ideas of what you can fill yours with. So here we go. Some of you might have thought this was a tip jar the way it was sitting up here. No. That's the offering basket, right? No, we don't want to start that. All right. Hope cherishes no illusions, nor does it yield to cynicism. This is a great place to start. A great place to start because one of the biggest myths about the world today is that it is a rotten place. And there's a lot wrong with the world, as we saw with the story of Lowell and Munir. But there's another way we can look at it. Steven Pinker is a researcher who spent years studying the history of violence amongst human beings. And he has demonstrated in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, that we are absolutely, absolutely on the decline as far as violence goes. And not only that, whether you're looking at war, murder, torture, anything, any indicator of violence, the present, right now, the world we live in is the most peaceful time in all of human history. So just take that in. This is the most peaceful time in all of human history. For all that is going on out there, all that needs fixing, we actually live in the most peaceful time in human history. It's both frightening and inspiring. It's a strange mix. But several reasons for this decline in violence point to empathy, including the increasing respect for a variety of voices, like those of women and other marginalized groups, the growing emphasis on reason, which has helped people recognize that privileging one's own interests over others is often destructive. Hey, what a surprise. And the rise of literacy and media, which has acquainted people with increasingly diverse perspectives. So yes, there is use for something like Facebook, and it widens our circles of empathy. So recognizing the strides the human race has made away from violence, that's an example of dealing in reality without cynicism. We don't need illusions either. Hope finds beauty in the world we live in, and there's a lot of beauty here, folks. We just have to look for it. So, what else do we have in here? Hope opens doors where despair closes them. Hope is specific and regards problems as opportunities. Of course. So, the way my brain works, I think of lentils. Lentils! So we've already established that the world is a better place than it's given credit for. But that's not to say there aren't real problems here. We know that. We know there are problems. Rural India, for instance, there's been a problem with the availability of immunizations for children. So some well-meaning people set up clinics offering free vaccinations. Now, what could go wrong with that? Well, for starters, nobody came. Imagine yourself in the shoes of a rural Indian mother, a mother whose eyes flicker with that steady strength found in the eyes of my great-grandmother. Now, you've heard about this immunization thing, but you don't really understand it, and you have no practical way of finding out more about it. And there's work to be done every day, meals to be cooked, and to take precious time to trudge a few miles away to this clinic where your child will cry as she's stuck with a needle seems like an annoying waste of time. And don't push it, the critics said, it'll take a few generations for the culture to shift. But the organizers didn't give up, and they did what they should have done in the first place. They actually talked to the people they were trying to reach. You know, amazing thing, but so often that doesn't happen. They heard their concerns and they asked them what would change the situation. And together they came up with a plan. Lentils. You get a 2-pound bag of lentils if you bring your child in to get vaccinated. 2-pound bag of lentils. So can you guess what happened? Suddenly there is a line. There is a line of people at that vaccination clinic. And then they go home to their villages carrying those bags of lentils. And people say, what's going on? What's the deal? And they say, just go right over there. And so it becomes a cultural norm. A dire situation is turned around because of some inexpensive bags of beans. Some critics have called those lentils bribes, but I contend that they represent hope. Hope for the people getting their children immunized. Now, these lentils are tangible reminders of the nourishment of the body, and what a valuable association that is for people who don't have access to comprehensive vaccination information, but they do understand the practicalities of feeding a family. And I contend that these lentils represent hope for us, too. We find hope in the specificity of this solution. Hope. In lentils, we see that this supposedly insurmountable problem, a problem that requires significant cultural and behavioral shifts, this is an opportunity to collaborate, to be practical amidst the voices of naysayers, to have hope when others are overwhelmed. And the solution is as simple and specific as a bag of lentils. It could have been a jar of peanuts, like it was for my grandmother. Hope isn't found in lofty abstracts. Hope is found in the specific. All right, so what else do we have in here? hope comes from unexpected people and places. Hope looks for the good in people instead of harping on the worst in them. Well, I know, I've never done that. Have you? I think back to when I worked as a chaplain at a large hospital, going from room to room, offering comfort where I could. And I'll never forget room 1503. So I'll confess, it was almost lunchtime, my stomach was growling, and I figured, oh, I could check on one more room, and then I'll go to lunch. After all, most of my patients that morning had been napping. Well, 84-year-old Ruth was not napping. No. She was sitting up in bed, pink scarf at her neck, contrasting with the drab hospital gown. Smiling, she gripped my hands in hers. "I've seen you around and knew you were a chaplain," she said. "You sure are the bright light I needed, honey." Ruth told me that the doctor said she didn't have a lot of time left. We talked for a while about her kids, grandkids, the husband who died a few years before, the garden where she raised tomatoes, and about queers. "It's the end of days, honey," she told me. "Satan at work in the world, queers all around actually getting married to each other, adopting those poor kids who have to share in their demonic lives." She shook her head and clucked her tongue while I sat there speechless. And let me tell you, at this point, I was just thinking, couldn't I have just gone to lunch? I mean, somebody else could have gone to... Anyway. So what was I supposed to say? Here I was, a gay man in this room with this woman, and as a chaplain, I'm supposed to, you know, explore spiritual concerns and offer comfort. How could I do that here when this woman believed in virtually everything I didn't? And not only that, would likely despise me if she knew more about me. So I'll admit that I was tempted to harp in my own mind on what I saw as the worst in her. But wiser people than me have taught me that our best opportunity for changing minds is by changing hearts. And that has to do with taking time to understand those, especially those people whose goodness may be hard for us to see. So there in that hospital room, I recognized that like it or not, easy or not, I was called to love this woman and offer her hope. Hope that she, unknown to her, was getting from an unexpected place. So I stayed and I talked with her. Now, it wasn't easy to let go of her previous words, but it was quickly evident that there were areas where we could relate. The love she felt for her family, the fear as she faced the reality of her failing body, and at one point in her eyes, I saw the vulnerability that I had seen in the eyes of my great-grandmother. And when I left, Ruth told me again what a bright light I was for her. But surprisingly, she ended up lighting the way for me, too, toward looking beyond the bad to the good in others and appreciating these unexpected wellsprings of hope. Through this unlikely loving encounter between two mismatched people, we both found hope. So I have a couple, I think two things left in this jar here. Now, if you're beginning to suspect this jar is rigged, you'd be right. Hope draws its power from a deep trust in God, nature, and or the basic goodness of humankind. We're Unitarian Universalists, so I always have to do the and or. It's always our choice. Unitarian Universalists come from hope-filled traditions. Universalism said that despite our flaws, all humanity was worthy of salvation, of being reconciled with divine love. And Unitarianism wasn't focused on the death of Jesus. It was what his life taught us that mattered, how we can become better, more loving people. And then humanism crept into our movement, recognizing the power in human potential, our ability to act right here on earth and make it a better place. And today we acknowledge we're all worthy of earthly salvation, of better lives, of growing to be our best selves. We trust in the idea that we're all created worthy of respect and love. And in this sacred trust, combined with the awe and wonder that the vast, powerful, and mysterious universe provokes within us, we find that source of hope that is the source of all other hope, however we choose to name or not name it. One last slip. Hope discovers what can be done instead of grumbling about what can't be done. That's another thing I've never been guilty of, right? We people of rational and liberal faith believe life is more than just survival. It's not enough to simply remain drowning in grief in tough times. When we hear stories like those of Lowell and Munir, it can be tempting for us to switch off and numb ourselves to what's going on out there in the world. But if we have filled our hope jars to the brim, we'll have enough hope, not just for ourselves, but for others. In our jars will be the knowledge that the world we live in now, for all its wounds, is the most peaceful it has ever been, and that there are those who help others when terrible events occur. We'll recognize that little things like bags of lentils, jars of peanuts, can be inspiration and even solutions to complex problems. We'll find hope in unlikely human connections, like that between a frightened woman and a gay man, and we'll fill our jars with images of children and grandchildren, spouses and friends, those people who keep us going when times are bad. When we have this foundation of hope, we'll be better equipped to empathize with those who appear drastically different from us, and we'll act out of that empathy, demanding from our leaders behaviors and policies that are ethical, geared toward peace, that embrace the full complexity of the spectrum of people's lives. For that, folks, that is what true justice making is all about. I was 14 years old when I last sat by my great-grandmother's bedside. I barely recognized her when I entered the hospital room. She was a century old. Sudden illness had left her body, a body that was always so tall and straight, frail. She didn't say much, but occasionally she would open her eyes and, I think, see me. And in her eyes, I saw something that took me years to understand. In those eyes, I saw the sorrow of Lowell in Jaar, the strength of the Indian mother taking her child to the vaccination clinic, the vulnerability of Ruth in the hospital room. She is in all those people, just as I am, just as you are. In those eyes, I saw that we are not alone. We are all one, and we must act accordingly. This is our great work, not just as Unitarian Universalists, but I believe as human beings. If there's a reason for us to be here, this is it: to recognize and act upon this fundamental connection with each other. It is a big task, but I have hope. I have hope that we can continue to improve our relations with each other, to reshape the world into the beloved community. I have hope because my great-grandmother taught me to fill my hope jar. And so my question to you is, what will you put in your hope jar? And I want to give you the opportunity to really answer that, for all of us to answer that as a community. So, on our welcome table, we're going to have a hope jar, and there will be cards for you to put, write something that gives you hope, something specific where you find hope. I want you to put those cards, this will be out here over the next few months, put those cards in this jar, and we're going to read them from time to time at a service, and we'll probably read them when we really need them. We have some possible things coming up that where we might really need a little extra dose of hope. So I want you to take that seriously and really make that a practice, because as a community, we learn from each other. Where you find hope might be a place I hadn't thought of, but I can find it there too. And truly, the sky is the limit. Our hope jars, the ones we carry with us inside, they should be as great as large as our hearts and minds can make them, as vast and colorful as the rainbow with the jar's bottom, just as elusive as the end of that rainbow. I'll take this final moment to thank my great-grandmother, long gone from this world, but alive in my heart, and I hope now in yours, for sharing her hope jar with us. May our hope jars and their contents never stop growing. And may we never forget to gaze with awe and wonder on the beauty and possibility of the world we live in. May we treasure it, nurture it, and hold each other through the movement of time and space. May it be so.